Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast spotlighting some of the area's most interesting and accomplished women. Storytelling has been a constant in Wanda Draper's life. The executive director of the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of African American History and Culture got her start in journalism and has since held various positions in communications. After graduating from the University of Maryland, Wanda worked here at the Sun on the Evening Sun staff and has also held positions at the National Aquarium and most recently at WBAL-TV as Director of Programming and Public Affairs. Wanda has been at the helm of the Lewis Museum since September, following the retirement of Skip Sanders, and she talked a little bit about what led to her career change and earlier what helped her survive in male-dominated newsrooms. She also discussed how she's addressing some of the museum's challenges, how Freddie Gray shifted the paradigm in Baltimore, and commanding respect. Here's our conversation. So normally I would ask you where you're from, but I know that you're from Baltimore because a past podcast guest, Diane Bell McCoy, actually credits you with being one of the reasons she moved here. So that's quite a claim to fame.
That's amazing. Diane and I met as children, and my godparents were friends with her parents, and that's how we met.
So you've been in Baltimore your whole life?
I have been in Baltimore my whole life.
And does your family go back generations, or when did your parents come here?
Well, my family go back generations. My father's side actually were not in Baltimore City, but they were in Anne Arundel County. My maiden name is Queen, and so there's something in Anne Arundel County called Queenstown, which is where my father's family hail from. And my mother's family were from the Eastern Shore, so for at least the last five generations, we have been Marylanders.
Did you ever want to leave?
I did think about it a couple of times. I had offers to be a reporter in different places. And as I thought about what the offer was and what I was doing here, I was always happier to be here. And the main reason I stayed here is to have a support system. When I was younger, it was like it would have been okay to move. But once I had children, I figured it was just much more convenient to be here and have a support system as opposed to trying to live one place and have a support system another place.
What part of town did you grow up in?
So I grew up in Forest Park, which is Northwest Baltimore. And it was a wonderful place to grow up because it was a real sense of community and everybody knew everybody. And the other thing was all the parents knew all the children, so they knew who you belonged to. And so everybody watched out for everybody and looked out for everybody. I grew up in a period where we didn't have to worry about crime. People were not snatching children. You could go out. Everybody went outside to play every day. And you knew it was time to go in when the streetlights came on, because that was time to go home. And we roller skated in the neighborhood. We did everything in the neighborhood. We played every kind of ball there was to be played. We took chalk and we drew hopscotch on the sidewalk out in front of people's houses. We played in the backyard. We had a peach tree in our backyard, so we ate everything peach, and so did all of our neighbors. But it was a fun time to grow up in Baltimore, and I felt very safe. I never felt threatened. It was a great time. We had good schools. I went to Baltimore City Public Schools. There were great schools where teachers cared about you, where you were challenged, and you were also rewarded for being smart. So you wanted to be smart and recognized for that. And, you know, parents used to, like, pay you for your report card. That was kind of a way of rewarding you. You know, you got a dollar for every A. And so it was a really good time to grow up in Baltimore.
Was there a time that you noticed a change or that it started to feel less safe to you or your family?
Well, we moved out of the city before that time, so I wasn't living in the city, but I did start to notice there was a change, and we started to see the change in our old neighborhood as houses that were family homes became rentals and apartments, and then you just started to see the change and some degradation in the community when the unemployment rate started to rise. I mean, when I was a kid, everybody had a job, and even if you didn't have the job you wanted, you had a job and you were able to take care of your family.
So you did well in school as a kid. Did you enjoy school?
I loved school. And the thing about me was I always loved to read. And so I would learn so much by, you know, just loving to read. And initially, I always thought that I would be a reading teacher because I love to read so much. And I used to walk to the Enoch Pratt Library and I'd borrow 5 books at a time and then challenge myself to see how long it would take me to read those 5 books. And I loved doing book reports. Whenever we had an assignment to do a book report, I'd do that first because that was my favorite thing to do. And I just thought that I really, really wanted to help other children read because I just felt it was so much fun for me.
Did you have any kind of inkling that you would go on to be a journalist at that time?
At that time, I did not. I thought about being a reading teacher. And then when I got to what is now middle school, we used to call it junior high school. But when I got to junior high school, we took a trip to a convent. And I thought it was so cool to be a nun. And the whole marriage ceremony with God when you become a nun, I was like, that is really cool. There was one little obstacle, and that was that I was not Catholic. But I went home and told my parents that I had decided I wanted to be a nun and live at the convent. And they were a little bit disturbed because I was born a Baptist, and there are no nuns or convents in the Baptist church. And so they were a little bit uneasy about me for that. For, you know, that probably lasted 6 months. And then I went back to wanting to be a reading teacher again. I didn't really get interested in journalism until I got to high school. And I had the opportunity to take a journalism class and work on the Forest Park High School newspaper. And that was when I got bit.
Do you remember the kinds of things you covered in high school?
Oh, I covered everything. I remember covering cheerleader tryouts. I covered all kinds of clubs, like the biology club had something. I covered when Spiro T. Agnew, who's a graduate of our high school, became vice president, and we marched in the inaugural parade. I would cover sports events. We had tennis championships, and I covered archery. It was, you know, the thing about it was being on a high school newspaper staff, you can cover just about anything you want because they're just looking for people to do it. And my life really changed when I covered McCall Patterns used to come to high schools and do fashion shows. So I was the one of the tallest girls in the school. So I was asked to be in the fashion show and to wear the gown at the close of the show. The person who covered that for the Baltimore News American was the fashion editor for that paper. And she came, and at the end, she had to leave before our show was over. So she asked me, because I was the reporter from our newspaper, if I would send her my story. So I sent her my story, which was for our high school newspaper, and she liked it so much that she printed it. And they asked me to come to the paper to work on a section called Young World and to be a correspondent. So I said, yes, I'd love it. And so I just started writing, and then they started paying me, and I didn't know I was hired. So I got hired by the News American, and I was in 11th grade in high school. And then they started having me come in on Saturdays and work there. And then one day, some of the guys in the newsroom, and it was mostly men, said they were going out for a drink and asked me, did I want to go? And I was like, no, I can't go. And they're like, why? I said, because I'm 15. And they were like, you're 15? But that was the truth. I was 15. And then they discovered that I didn't have a work permit and I was illegal. So I had to go to the state office building and get a work permit. And I loved working there. And so I worked there every summer and on holidays and every spring break. I worked at the News American while I attended the University of Maryland and got a degree in journalism.
I'm a fellow Philip Merrill grad, so go Terps.
Absolutely.
So what was it about journalism and eventually about broadcast journalism that appealed to you?
Well, one of the things, I always love to tell a story. I love to read and I love to write. Those are the three main ingredients. And once I started writing for the high school newspaper, I realized that for me, that was a great form of expression. I loved being able to tell a story and communicate. And once I started seeing my writing in print, I just got such a sense of satisfaction. And also the opportunity to meet people and interview people and cover events, that just excited me to no end. So I definitely decided that was what I wanted to do. Now, the problem with that is the year that I graduated, Money Magazine had a cover story that said, and it talked about specifically journalism majors. And it said, for every 10 journalism majors, and this was 1973, that only 1 in 10 would get a job. And I read that and it really shook me. It frightened me. And then I decided, well, there are going to be 9 other people who don't get a job because I'm getting a job. So I was really hoping that the News American would keep me on after I graduated, but I'd go there Saturday after Saturday. I went there on spring break. Nobody said anything. So by now, I'm there 5 years. And so I'm thinking they're going to hire me, but nobody said anything. So in December, when I came home for spring break, the Baltimore Sun called me and asked me to come in for an interview. I did. They hired me. So they hired me in December to start the following May. So I go back to school, I'm finishing my last semester, I'm still working at the News American, and then probably 3 weeks before graduation, the editor at the News American called me in and said, so let's talk about when you're going to come on board full time. And I looked at him because I had accepted the job at the Sun. And I said, I had no idea you were going to offer me a position. He said, what did you think? You've been here forever. And I said, well, nobody asked me. And the Sun invited me for an interview. And I accepted a position there to start on. I gave him the exact date. And he looked at me and he says, I can't believe you. You're fired. So 3 weeks before graduation, I got fired.
And then you picked right back up.
And then 3 weeks later, I started at the Baltimore Sun, and I spent 10 years at the Sun as a reporter.
And you were on the Evening Sun staff, right?
I was on the Evening Sun staff, and I did a lot. I loved feature writing, so I came on when the Sun feature section, it used to be called Women's World, and in 1973, they decided to change it, and it was called Accent, and that became a feature section so instead of just a women's section. So I was the first reporter on the Accent section, and I also wrote for the Sunday Magazine.
What was your experience like here? And I imagine that there probably weren't a lot of women on staff at the time. Is that a fair assumption?
That is more than a fair assumption. And I didn't really think about that. I was so glad to be coming on board. And at the time, the Sun was one of the top 10 papers in the country. So here I am, you know, I'm 20 years old. I got my degree in journalism on May 19th, and on May 21st, I was a reporter at the Baltimore Sun. So for me, everything was just overshadowed by the excitement of getting my dream job. So I came here, and there was one other woman. There were no other black women, obviously, and I was one of the youngest people in the newsroom. And it was a whole different experience. But I was so excited about being here, it didn't really bother me. And then when I got to go to the bathroom, the newsroom was on the 5th floor, and there was no ladies' room on the 5th floor where the newsroom was. And so that kind of startled me, and I asked about that. And then they cleaned out a broom closet and had a plumber put a toilet in, and that became the ladies' room. So it was a really interesting experience, and the guys would often say, oh, well, they're going to let her do that because she's a woman, you know. But for me, I got to write so many great stories and cover so many great things that it really didn't bother me. And then one day I was sitting next to a guy who was the president of the newspaper union. And we started talking, and he started talking about his paycheck, because at the time they used to deliver your paycheck to your desk. And I discovered that he was making more money than me. And so I asked him, so I'm only making this, why are you making this? And he said, oh, I don't know. And so I went into the managing editor and said, so could you explain to me why I'm making less money than this other person? And he said, I'll get back to you. Okay, so I walk out. Next paycheck, I'd get the same amount of money. And that was when I discovered that women were making 49 cents to every dollar that men were making. So I was the first woman to get equal pay to the male reporters. And that was exciting for me.
Was that intimidating at all?
I really wasn't intimidated. I was shocked because I didn't expect that. I mean, nobody had said, you're going to make less money or there are no women there. So I came in with no fear. So as a result of that, as everything happened, I just asked about it. After I'd been here, I came in 73. So in 1977, I got pregnant. And since they had so few women reporters, they'd never had to deal with a pregnant reporter, and they didn't know what to do with me. So I went in to have the conversation in private with my managing editor, and he was busy. And so she said, his assistant said to me, I'll let you know when he's free. So what I expected was that she'd come out and tell me he was free, and I could go in and speak to him. That is not what happened. What happened was he came out of his office and sat on the corner of my desk in the middle of the newsroom in front of everybody and proudly announced, "So, I hear you're knocked up," which was a little bit of a shock. I looked up and then he says, "Are you even married?" And I said, "Well, you know, I got married 2 years ago and you came to my wedding." and then he says, "Well, what do you want me to do about it? We've never had this happen here before. I don't even know what to do with you." And so I looked at him and said, "Well, my baby is due in July and I'd like 6 months off." He said, "Fine," and walked away because there was no policy there. So they didn't know what to do. So I got 6 months maternity leave and I was off from July to January and I came back to work in January.
So, of course, you've been in many leadership positions since that time, but have you found that you've encountered a lot of the same challenges at your jobs over the years? And how much, if at all, have things gotten better in your experience?
I think women have gotten more opportunities, but I remember going to a newspaper conference in Boston, and actually I went with Gwen Ifill, and she and I were, I think there were three women in the newsroom, and she and I would only do black people in the newsroom, so we went together to this conference. And it was a conference for women in journalism. So we go there, and we're excited to be there, and we're excited to see these other women from all over the country, because we were still relatively new in the field. So we were all excited and very glad to be there. And we're sitting in this one session on women in news gathering, it was called. I'll never forget it. And this woman from Boston gets up, and there are probably 50 women in the room, all journalists. And we were the only two black people in the room. And she started talking about women moving forward and how many women there are now in the industry. And we were feeling good. And she also started talking about how our pay was, you know, moving toward being equal and how we were among the top 2% of women in terms of earnings. And it was really good. And then she looked at us and she said, "Well, one thing you two have to understand is that white women are at least 10 years behind men in this industry, and you have to be 10 years behind us." And we were like, "Wow, that's scary." But one of the things that I have found is competence helps. Once people see your work and you let your work speak for yourself, you will get respect. And you also have to respect yourself and demand respect, because if you let them mistreat you, they will. If you do not tolerate mistreatment, they will respect you.
Have you always had that confidence?
Well, I did, and I think it came from my mom. My mom's always a very confident person, and I grew up in a very traditional family. On my father's side, the women did not work. So my grandmother did not work, did not drive a car, and did not write a check. My grandfather did everything and ruled the roost, and she didn't do anything or go anywhere without asking him. And everywhere she went, he drove her. And so when my father married my mother, it was like, wow, because my mother's side of the family, the women did things. The women worked, the women went to school, the women drove. And so when I decided that I was going to be a journalism major, there was a big deal in the family. There was this whispering going on in the family. You know, when the two sides of the family came together and they'd say, "Well, you know, the women in my family have traditionally been teachers and nurses and things that they could relate to. So when I wanted to do this, the thought was, well, you know what her problem is. Her mother works."
Like, that's a problem.
So that was the problem. Her mother works, so, you know, she's a little.
So was your mother supportive?
So my mother was very supportive and always very confident. And my mother always taught me, you know, my father's line was, be the best you can be, good, better, best. Never let it rest until your good is better and your better is best. You know, that was kind of his philosophy. And he always told me that nobody was responsible for taking care of me but my parents. And so he wanted me to be prepared to take care of myself. And my mother was always very confident, you know, you can do this. Don't let anybody tell you you can't do it. If you want to do it, you make it happen. And so as a result of that, I was very confident. And I think that's what helped me survive in the newsroom, because otherwise it was very difficult to survive in the newsroom, because men said all sorts of things to you. And it really, really didn't bother me that much.
So was going to museums a part of your childhood?
Going to museums had been part of my childhood. And one of the things I'd also done was, as a reporter too, was cover a lot of museums and museums events. And I'd always enjoyed it. I, you know, my parents even, you know, I went to New York and went to theater and went to museums. So I had been exposed to culture.
When you came to the Lewis Museum in September, you were coming off of several decades at WVAL, right?
Absolutely.
Did that feel like a risk? And what prompted such a career change?
Well, what prompted such a career change for me actually started in 1999. I was asked to serve on the Lewis Museum board. And when I was first asked, I said no. I was working at WVAL, and they actually wanted someone with media and public relations experience on the board. And I said, no, I was busy and I really didn't have the time. I had launched a new show at the time and I was executive in charge of production and I didn't have the time. And so then they asked me again and I kind of just like didn't respond to the call. So about 2 weeks later, I got a letter from Governor William Donald Schaefer saying I had been appointed by the governor to the board.
So you didn't have a choice.
So, I mean, like, who says no to the governor appointing you to something? I'd never heard of that. So I decided I couldn't do that. So I went to the board meeting and I was so impressed by the commitment of the people on that board. They had an idea. And they were determined that they were going to make that idea a reality. And I had served on nonprofit boards before. And usually when you get invited to serve on a board, you know, the organization is there, the building is there. The only thing they want you to do is give money or get money. That's all they want out of the board members. You know, show up once or twice a year, but give money or get money or both. And so here was a board that wasn't what they wanted. What they really wanted was my expertise. And there were a lot of very wealthy people on the board, which is what it took. And they did not treat me any different because I wasn't wealthy. And so it was exciting because we'd meet and we all have ideas and we all brought very different perspectives to the table. And I'm talking about 30 people. And we'd all talk about what we wanted and how we were going to get there. And, you know, just think about this. At the time, it was only an idea. There was nothing. So finally, we started looking at buildings and we started looking at land and looking for a site. And finally, we found the site on President Street. And we negotiated with the city and we got a 98-year lease on the land for $1 a year. That's a good real estate deal. And then we started working with the state and Peter Angelos gave us $1.2 million to hire an architect and get started. So we hired an architect. So the board then started to raise money. And so between 2000 and 2005, we raised $38 million and got the museum built, and I chaired the grand opening. And we also raised $2 million to install the permanent exhibit. So the museum opened and was fully paid for, and so there was no debt. So for me, that was very exciting to see something be a vision and have this dream become a reality. So I stayed on the board until 2008. So I was on the board a little over 8 years. And then I thought, you know, it's kind of time for some younger person to come on and, you know, take the museum forward. So I left the board in 2008. And over the years, I'd have a number of events there. Whenever we premiered movies or new TV shows or something, we would rent the museum. And I'd go there periodically and I'd say, you know, they need to do this or they should be doing this. And I'd mention it to a few people and I'd move on. And so finally, last year when they asked me about coming back to the museum, my first response was probably not, because I really never thought about doing anything but broadcasting. And I'd been at WBAL for 25 years. I was happy. And I loved what I was doing. And then I thought about it, and the museum was at a position where it really needed management. And that's the one thing I could do. And I thought, you know, I'm really at the stage in my life where I can do something like this. And I thought I could bring a perspective, because I knew what the original vision was. I knew how it all got there. And I thought I knew enough about it to be able to manage it and move it forward. And, you know, most people think of museum executive directors as museum professionals or educators. And the Lewis Museum had all of that. But what they needed at this point was management. You know, after 2008, one of the things that happened to a lot of nonprofits was when the economy crashed, they all suffered. And the Lewis Museum was no different. But when you have, I mean, how many nonprofits would like to have an 82,000 square foot building all paid for and a totally, totally paid for exhibit? You know, that's a really big deal. It's an awesome building. It's in an awesome location. The collection, there are about 10,000 artifacts in the collection. All of that's there. So what needed to happen was it just needed management through that so that you could move that museum forward. And as I talked to the board, I believed I could do that. And so it was interesting. They asked me to come in and meet with the board, and I figured like five people would show up. And I got there and there were 30 people. And I was like, wow. And I thought, you know, if I'm supposed to be here, I will. If not, I'll go back to WBAL. And I left the meeting with the board, and I got on the foot of the Jones Falls. And before I got to the top of the Jones Falls, the board had voted unanimously for me to be the executive director. And I thought, this is where I'm supposed to be at this point in my life.
Because you were part of the original board before the museum even existed, you kind of have this unique insight. And how would you say the original vision for the museum, I guess how closely does the current Lewis Museum match up with the original vision that you had for it?
Very closely. The center of the museum's mission and goal is education. And one of the things that the original board put in place was a curriculum for kindergarten through 12th grade. Because the thing about it is, while it's called the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture, it is really American history and culture. It's really Maryland history and culture. It's told through, some of the stories are told through African Americans, but it really does affect everyone. And most of all, what the collection shows is that we are really all more alike than we are different. And so now what we're looking at is updating that curriculum. We've now put that curriculum online so that all teachers and students can access it. So it's moving forward and adopting to the times what the original vision was. You know, introducing apps, updating our distance learning center. We have some new tours. We have a new tour called Genealogy, where we take 12 artifacts and cover 400 years of history in 1 hour. Because people want it quicker now. They want technology now. They want things to be more interactive. And so that's what we're doing. We're looking at taking what we have and moving it forward to the 21st century.
Do you think Baltimoreans are generally museum goers? Like, what is the appetite for museums in this city?
Well, I think Baltimore is on par with the country, and about 13% of Americans go to museums. And I think Baltimore and Maryland is about, you know, right about there. I think the way we increase that number is bringing more kids in through school groups. So once you start exposing children to become museum goers, then they grow up to be adult museum goers.
Do you remember any school trips that you took to museums?
So I remember we went to the BMA. It was the only museum school trip I took, but we went to the BMA. And I just remember thinking it was one of the most beautiful buildings I'd ever seen.
Besides school children, what is your ideal audience for the Lewis Museum, or a group of people who maybe aren't coming that you would like to see come?
So, of course, we would like to see more school children come, but we'd like to see more families come. And one of the things I've seen since being there this fall is more families are now living downtown, and they're coming out and walking around, and they come by the museum and they come in. So we would like to see more families come to the museum, and we're doing things to help attract more families to the museum. We do something for younger children on Saturdays called Saturday's Child. We do family activities. We do lectures. We do Sunday movie matinees for families. So we're looking at directing our programming, our special programming, toward attracting families. And of course, we also want to attract millennials, and we're doing that. We have something called Floetic Fridays, and we're getting like 300 people come to that. So that's exciting for us. And we're just looking at how we target people in our market to come to our museum.
And I remember I went to the Devon Allen front room, and so I'm sure that was like a good, get people in the door, especially millennials, to go see this, big Baltimore photographer.
Absolutely. Our exhibits always work. Now we have an exhibit called Sons, Portrait of African American Males, because so many times when non-African Americans, they're so afraid of African American men. And, oftentimes it can be a college professor, it can be a rocket scientist, but because they're African American, there's this fear. So what this exhibit does is they're all Maryland African-American men, and it shows you a picture of them, and it asks you, what do you think? Would you get in an elevator with him? Would you share a cab with him? Those kinds of things. And then in the end, you see who it is. And you see that these are people just like everybody else with jobs and families. And it's African-American men and their sons. And in one case, it's three generations. It's the father, the son, and the grandchildren. And so that's an exhibit that we curated and that the museum owns. And we also right now have, there was a statewide art contest among high school students. And so the winner statewide, the juried art contest, is now on exhibit. And you can walk in the museum and see that even without paying admission, because we want all children and families to see the artwork that our high school students are doing. And then we have our permanent collection. And our next exhibit will be a very special exhibit of Jacob Lawrence. And all of the works in the exhibit will be owned by Maryland families.
I know that this happened, of course, before you came to the Lewis Museum, but how would you say the arrest and death of Freddie Gray shifted the focus or the goals of the museum, if at all?
Oh, I think it shifted the paradigm, because I think now there needs to be more discussion about race relations. And I think the museum's the perfect place to have that. And we have been doing that. Recently, we had an exhibit called Ken Killing Ken, and it was an Ohio artist who painted 14 pieces, and it juxtaposed the violence, mostly in urban and African American communities, on street corners to the Ku Klux Klan. Because one of the things this artist discovered in his research was that violence on street corners are killing 10 times the number of African Americans that the Ku Klux Klan killed. So it was a very moving exhibit. And what we did was invited a predominantly African American high school in Baltimore City and a predominantly non-African-American private school in Baltimore County. And they were all high school students. We gave them the same assignments and watched how they each perceived it, and then had them sit down together and have a discussion. That probably wouldn't have happened before Freddie Gray. The other thing that we're doing is we'll be working this summer with some of the organizations in the Sandtown Winchester area. And I am still on the board of the WBAL Kids Campaign. And one of the things we did after Freddie Gray was send 400 students from Sandtown to summer camp, because when people started to look at Sandtown and look at neighborhoods like that in the city, they started looking at providing services, but we didn't see anybody looking at the children. So we decided to do something specifically for the children. So we sent the children to summer camp for 8 weeks. They got transportation, they got three meals, they go on a trip every Friday. So we're looking to partner with them this summer and have those kids come to the museum as their Friday trip.
Like you said, African-American history is, of course, just American history. But would you say that people don't always see that? I mean, do people view the Lewis Museum as very niche? And are there a lot of non-African-American patrons?
Well, now there are, and I think they have viewed it as niche. I think we've been helped tremendously by the Smithsonian African American History Museum. And I think what happened with that is on a national front, like when somebody says to you, let's go to the streetcar museum or the children's museum, you know what that is, or any art museum. Immediately, you have a visual. You know what to expect. When somebody says, let's go to an African-American museum of history and culture, you don't have a picture. You don't know what that is. You don't know what to expect. And depending on your exposure, your comfort level may not be there to feel comfortable coming into that museum. What the Smithsonian Museum has done is told the whole country that it's a safe place to go, that it's interesting, that there are things there that you can relate to, and you should feel comfortable with coming. So we're starting to see an uptake in attendance because of that. We're starting to see buses come from Washington because it's so crowded over there now. They come to our museum because they can walk through. It's less crowded. You can get in our gift shop. We're starting to see people come and because they now feel comfortable because they know what to expect. So I think the more we dialogue and interact with each other, I think the more people will come. And that's what we're seeing.
So you haven't seen competition from the Smithsonian Museum? I know that that seemed to be a concern before it opened.
I think the competition is people will go there and their story is a national story. But when you come to the Lewis Museum, you see the Maryland story. So it's competitive in that it's the same subject matter, but the content is so different. And for our visitors to come to a local museum and see the local story. So, you know, if you see what happened with the Underground Railroad in Baltimore, those are streets you walk down or pass by. If you look at our exhibit, our son's exhibit, you see people that you know. You see our elected officials, our college professors, you see people that work in organizations that you're familiar with. So there's a certain familiarity with seeing Maryland history as opposed to United States history.
So you have been in this position since September. What was the learning curve like? What has it been like? And is there anything that has surprised you about this job?
Well, the learning curve has been, I've been in a corporate environment and not a nonprofit environment. So making the adjustment, things move a lot slower. You know, I came from an industry where we measure time in 10-second increments. We sell time in 10-second increments. And then all of a sudden be there, it's where, yeah, your board meets every 2 months. Oh, I got to wait 2 months for this to get approved? Are you kidding me?
That's what you hear from anyone who leaves journalism. Any of my friends who have switched jobs or anything, it's always like, everything just seems so slow now.
It does seem so slow. And I have to pace myself and remind myself it's not really going to get done as fast as I am accustomed to. And so that's probably the biggest difference. The other thing is I now have to testify before the General Assembly for my budget, which is new. You know, I'm used to going to my budget hearing, making my case and people saying yay. and now I have to go, I have to testify, I have to wait for them to vote, you know, so that's probably the biggest difference.
Would you say that there is a lot of overlap between the skills that made you a successful journalist and the skills you're using now?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, once you learn management skills, you can hire people with expertise. I can hire artists, I can hire curators, I can hire fabricators. But what the difference is, I can bring my management skills to the table and apply them, and they still work because managing an organization, managing people, those skills are the same.
Like you mentioned, with the recession in 2008, nonprofits took a hit. I know the museum attendance has been down. Corporate donations were down. I mean, how do you recover from that? And how big of a challenge has that been?
It is a big challenge, but one of the things that's helping is our economy is coming back. So that's helping people who are interested in attending, reaching new audiences of people who'd never thought about attending. We're also looking at reaching a broader donor base and soliciting support for the museum. The fact that the state has continued to support the museum has been very helpful. And I think that says to other donors, donors that the state still believes in this museum, so we should too. And we're starting to meet with donors and have them come back and say, oh, we see what you're doing, we see what your plan is, and we're being supportive. So we've been excited about that. One of the other differences, when the museum opened, schools had budgets to provide buses to bring students, and now that's not the case. So one of the things we're doing is raising money for our CAP fund, cultural access program we call it, and that is to provide buses to bring students to the museum. And so you have to do business a little different way today. You know, when you have, particularly in Baltimore City, a school system with a major deficit, the last thing on the list is taking kids on a school trip. We still think that's important. And when we met with the State Department of Education, we usually talk about working with students in social studies and history, because we're a history and culture museum. And one of the things, one of the assistant superintendents said to us, we're now looking at this another way, a broader way, because when students come to the museum, they have an experience, and that experience grows to expression, because when they have that experience, they need to express it. And in English class, they're writing that out, and that becomes their form of expression. So they have learned more than science and social studies from their visit. They've learned how to write about it or how to speak about it. And so those are differences in the kinds of things we're doing to make the adjustments to be current to the needs of people who are coming to the museum today.
What is something you would love to do with the museum in your fantasy that is not really feasible right now, too expensive, but just a larger, grander vision?
Oh, I have a list.
I figured.
So, one of the things I would love to do is to have a high-tech way to experience our exhibit. So we'd love to have apps so that you could go on your app and interact with our exhibits on your cell phones. We would like to have talking tours, which we don't have, so you could walk through and experience it without having to read every little label. We would also like to update. We have a distance learning center, but the equipment is old. The equipment is from 2005. So we would like to update our distance learning center so we could do classes at the museum, and then children all over the world could watch those classes. That would be very exciting, and we are looking at that.
Beyond education, what role do you think the Lewis Museum and maybe museums at large serve to the Baltimore community?
I think the museums serve as a place for people to experience culture. And it's very important that people experience culture and experience the culture of others. So not just the culture that you live in, but to love and respect other people's culture, you know. So if you come to the museum and you see an Indian dance troupe, that gives you exposure to another culture and something that you may not have seen before. If you come to our author series or to our movie series and you see something and experience something different, that's growth for us as people and as individuals. And so that's what I think, that's a key part that museums play.
Wanda, thanks so much for speaking today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Wanda Draper. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. You can subscribe to Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. And it would help us out if you gave us a rating on iTunes. Female Trouble is also online at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. You can shoot us a tweet at FMLTrouble or email me at qkelly@baltsun.com. And that's qkelly@baltsun.com. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring Baltimore's own TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back next Tuesday. Dope girls. Dope girls. Dope girls.